All right.
Awesome.
Ready?
Hit me.
Hello, BattleTech fans. Welcome to Renegade HPG. This is Travis, and today I'm excited to welcome Lauren Coleman to the podcast. Lauren is the owner of Catalyst Game Labs and current steward of the BattleTech license. For our conversation today, we're going to dive into some of Lauren's early history as a creator for the IP and explore his experiences with Catalyst Game Labs and bringing this world back into the spotlight within the gaming community. Lauren, thanks for joining me today.
I'm happy to be here. Very excited.
Definitely. Before we dive in, I did want to give a shout out to the Wolfnik guys because they had done a podcast with you in January. And so, anybody listening, I encourage you to check that out after this one. I want to make sure that we're not kind of retreading a lot of the same stuff because I got tons of stuff I want to go over. If you want some more kind of story time and stuff, I definitely recommend people swing over there as a compliment to this podcast. But Lauren, I wanted to, I love talking about creators. I love hearing about the creative process, kind of get that little history into BattleTech from the perspective of those creators. And for you, coming into BattleTech as a writer, I'd really like to hear about kind of those early experiences you had first as a contributor to the source books and then kind of evolving into the novel side of things. But to focus first on those source books specifically, I'm curious what that process is like because there's so many authors credited on those source books, and you never know who's doing what within them. And I know that you spend a lot of time as a freelancer, and that's kind of how you guys continue to kind of outsource a lot of your work, especially your writing work now. And what kind of insight you can give into what that is like and how you contribute and where the direction is coming and how you kind of bring your own vision into the universe through that medium.
Wow, there's a lot in there to unpack. I got my start by I met Sam Lewis at a writing a writer's workshop. I didn't know who he was. A friend of mine, Greg Gordon, introduced us. Greg was a major writer at that point for doing game design. He was designing Earthdawn for FAFSA, among other things. Met Sam Lewis. Sam invited me to just write a couple things up for BattleTech. And so he handed me off to Brian Nystuhl. Brian gave me an assignment. I did that. I did how to game master the current BattleTech RPG section. And Brian liked my writing. So Brian said, "Hey, how about there's this new idea we have called a field manual, about 80,000 words. Go write that for us." No, hardly any is like. It's just a deep dive on the Gross Combine, T&E, units, histories, people. It was wide open, complete Wild West for me. And I went from writing like a 10,000 word piece to an 80,000 word source book. And Brian threw me right in the deep end of the pool and then tied weights around my ankles. Very nice guy.
Awesome.
And it was great. I mean, I already knew BattleTech. I'd been reading. Reading it, had played it some, and so it was very exciting for me. And I did that, and that started my kind of like a rise at FAFSA because I pulled that off in pretty record time, and suddenly I was writing at least two source books a year at that point for FAFSA. Almost immediately, I could turn in stuff. I could write fast, hit deadlines. I could work with minimal supervision. And so they really gave me a lot of room to play. And I mean, I invented this the almost the format for the field manuals, just sitting there as I wrote, I discovered where how to format what I wanted to say. And that became the format for all the field manuals thereafter. And they gave me a lot of room. So I played a lot. I was able to put my own stamp on some of the people and events of the timeline. Made up a lot of background material that eventually showed up in later source books and novels. It's such a huge universe. I mean, there's no way to traffic cop at all. So they didn't even try. They trusted me not to go too far off the reservation, and we had a great time. So that's how I kind of started writing the source books, and I was like one of their premier. Me, Chris Hartford, eventually Chris Trossen. We were doing, all of us were doing anywhere from one, two, even sometimes three source books in a year. sometimes working together, sometimes not. Little stuff like Dragon Roar's campaign play, up to Force Man or field manuals and big chunks of other rule books. So it was great. And I started doing like fiction snippets in there, and that was helped me make my case for doing a Baltic novel. I met Donna Ippolito, the editor at Gen Con, my first Gen Con that next year. And she looked at some stuff I had written and said, hey, this is good stuff, but you're like a whole year out of date, at least a year, if not 2 years out of date. We are writing way past this era, because they were planning out the Twilight of the Clans at that point.
Okay.
So I was so far behind the curve as to where the storyline was being written. She said, this is good, but we can't use it. But I'll keep you in mind. And I think it was only like maybe a few months after Gen Con, she called me and said, someone just dropped their novel. They can't get it done. They punted. And we've got a hole in our schedule. Would you like to write a Baltic novel in the current timeline? It was basically set really close to Twilight of the Clans, but it would not be involved. It would be like back in the Inner Sphere, what's been going on. Yep. I said, well, of course I would like to do that. And she said, and we need it in 2 months. And can you do that? I said, of course I can do that. Hung up the phone and went, okay, now what do I do? Because I had no idea if I could write a novel in 2 months' time.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how I got my first break in doing a novel. And then I called Brian, and Brian said, yeah, we want you to do this novel. Donna said, you're doing it. So here's the thing. You must do these seven things. And they were like all over the map. You know, make the Capella Confederation cool was number one on the list. I'm like, okay, come on. They've never been cool. I can do that. Nope. You know, show off some mercenaries, play with the periphery. You know, like he had all these weird touchstones. And I looked at that and went, okay, I see a way to do it, but I have to have a main character. I need a major character. I need Sun Tzu Lao to make this, tie this together. So Brian went to Mike Stackpole and said, can Lauren borrow Sun Tzu? And Mike said, let him borrow and see what he does with him. And that was Double Blind.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how that was my avenue into the industry. I had done a little work before then for like Mayfair Games. I think I wrote one thing for another company, I can't remember, Rolaids line. That was also Mayfair Games. But that's, you know, that was my big splash coming in.
Definitely.
And I worked for FASA pretty much 90% was my work for the next several years was all FASA all the time. So that's how I came in.
I love that. So you traded, I gave you a lot to unpack. You gave me a lot to unpack. And so I got a lot of questions coming out of that.
Yeah.
The field manual first. And so when you're, I know it must have been a lot easier kind of in the early days writing those things because you don't have as much established lore going on that you got to go back and check and make sure you're not conflicting. And so from what you were saying, it sounds like that was early enough where there was a lot of stuff you were able to kind of just freely develop the universe. I'm curious how much time when you're writing something like that is spent in kind of going back and kind of double checking and researching what's been done before and what's already been established first, kind of moving it forward with your own storytelling.
Writers become instant experts. We know how to get the most out of the most information and the least amount of research because we just don't have time.
Yeah.
In this case, the biggest issue was knowing which units in the Combine were storied units. They had backstory somewhere else in the source books.
Mm-hmm.
At that point, I had photocopies of the house books that Brian had given me and some other digital stuff. But it was hard because some of these units that were like, you know, the fourth Tossetti, the Sword of Light, the Genyosha, the Vagan, whatever Theodore's unit was. I mean, so I had to go read Heir of the Dragon just to talk about, you know, Theodore's, you know, regiment. And, you know, the Sword of Light appears in several source books. And I gleaned as much as I could, as fast as I could. There was no research team. There was no continuity checkers. It was me on the phone with Brian Nystol occasionally going, is there anything about the Arcab Legion I need to be aware of? He's like, nah, don't worry about it. Just go. You know, how about the Sword of Light? Oh, yeah, make sure you mention like this and this and this and just go.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of just, if we get it wrong, we'll deal with it later. Fortunately, I think I got most of it. You know, there were a few places where I had some maybe some overlap where I missed a bet, but mostly my quick research was pretty solid. And again, Brian's advice, because Brian knew the source books, he knew where to find the big references, and that assisted me a great deal. It was wide open, but still, I was always cognizant of the fact that there was still a lot of history out there in the house books and the Succession Wars manual and all the stuff that was out there that I had to go find, because I wanted to make sure. I didn't want a fan coming to me at a convention going, "You said they were here and they were actually over here." And okay.
Yeah. Anyway, yeah. That's right. I'm curious, because there's a lot of books that are written from a future perspective, from Comstar, Word of Blake, whoever it may be, who's kind of the overseer faction at the time. And is there coordination from the staff, other than just kind of giving you guys kind of a way to maneuver around? Is there a coordination in terms of what is more definitive than the other? If you're seeing something, you know, from that future perspective, is that kind of the go-to when you see conflicts versus what might be in a book from the perspective of the faction itself?
There's a lot of leeway we have in that, how we present the book. Like, you know, the field manuals, I believe, were presented as an internal document. And so I think on that one, we bypassed the Comstar's outside perspective where they were always commenting on things. Mm-hmm. We did it as a complete internal true document. Every source book was different. We did source books that were completely deniable. Things that were like, you know, here's a source book, nothing of which may be true. Some of which probably is, we won't know for years. Mm-hmm. We will decide later. You know, that was the jihad books we did. Right. They were completely apocryphal. Is how we wrote that. That was by design, because we were still trying to get a handle on how long this was going to run. We were working without a net at that point. And so we had to have, everything had to be deniable, at least to some extent, so we could then backfill later with what was actually going on, because nobody knew. They say, write a source book. What's going on? We can't tell you. There's some fighting. Word of Blake's going crazy. There's some jumbled communications. Everything's deniable. Just write something. I'm like, okay. So you know, that kind of thing was, that's at that point, I think Catalyst was actually publishing, or we were, that was the very end of the FASA era, beginning of, or FanPro era, beginning of Catalyst. Mm-hmm. But, you know, along the way, every book is handled at what point of view, where in the timeline are we? What is the point of view on this book? Is there a second point of view? Like, hey, here's an internal document that's been found by the other factions that we can comment on from both sides. I mean, that's always a great thing to start with. Say, okay, where are we at? Who is doing the commenting? Who is actually putting it together? And that let us do some really creative stuff. And there was no master plan. Every book was looked at on its own to say, where does it make the most sense to set this and to write it from what point of view? That was book by book. And still, even today, that is really the way we still do it. We go with what makes the most sense for the book, because it's such a huge universe. Say, well, we want to do this very narrow book about the Draconis Combine, but you don't want to forget the Davians. So how about we have a Draconis Combine product that was stolen by the Davians so they can comment on it? That way we get two factions, and at least two factions in the book. You know, we do that all the time still to make sure we don't leave anybody out.
And kind of leveraging that into Double Blind, you know, I was able to go back and kind of reread that in Binding Force. So I definitely want to kind of focus on those two books and ask questions on there. Leading into, and you had time to touch on this before, but in my conversation with Sam Lewis, who has got to be one of the most fun podcast guests that I've had. We've had him on multiple times.
Sam is awesome.
But he had dropped a little nugget in that kind of on his way out from FASA, he had kind of like giddily dropped the bomb that Leo is going to become a dominant force, make it happen, and then ran away with a smile on his face. And so it sounded like that was a fairly accurate assessment in terms of what you had commented on earlier.
I'm not sure about dominant force, but definitely from Sam and through Brian, what I heard was, we're going to focus on the Capellan. We've never focused on Confederation really at all. They've been the Baltic whipping boy for 15 years.
Yep.
We want to start showcasing them, and we want to make them cool, so people actually want to play and be a Confederation faction member, because there really hadn't been much of anything before that time. So it definitely was in the notes to focus on the Confederation, make them cool, make them someone, make them rich, give them some history, give them some culture. And there's that hadn't been done. So I got to create, I really feel like I got to create a faction in BattleTech. I mean, they already existed, but only on the barest, in the barest possible means. The Confederation House book was a nice start, but it seems like that was done, and then nobody looked at that book for like the next 5-10 years, because almost every time they showed up in the novels or something, they were extremely two-dimensional. They had no depth to them at all. So I went back and reread that House book several times and really took it to heart. Say, okay, let's take this material. Let's also update it. Let's really make these warehouses a living, breathing, you know, a system of I guess you'd call them like almost like pseudo religious military organizations. I mean, they have their own culture, their own mythology, their own everything. And you know, that was my goal in Binding Force, was to bring a warrior house alive.
Yeah.
Double Blind was mostly about just the machinations of how does such a small successor state stay alive. Mm-hmm. And the Confederation was always about Max was supposed to be this brilliant guy that he could twist and turn and keep everyone guessing, and then he went crazy. So I had to do that again and bring Sun Tzu up as a real character to say, how does they stay alive? Because Sun Tzu is really, really good at machinations, and he's completely ruthless. He will do what it takes to make sure his realm survives. So that was Double Blind. I showed that for the first time. That's why I knew at the very end that he was going to basically pull the trigger himself on drop the hammer himself on a main character.
Right.
And then Binding Force was to bring a warrior house alive and show the mythology, the culture, and show it from the point of view of an outsider, so I could really dive into what, you know, as an outsider, Eris Sung could showcase all the little stuff. He didn't know anything coming in, except he wanted to belong somewhere. And so he got to learn as he went, which means the reader got to learn as we went. So that's where Binding Force came from. It was just about showcasing this and bringing it alive for really almost the first time ever.
Definitely. And kind of focusing on Double Blind, that also seems to be the first time we really focused on Periphery Faction as well.
Yep.
And so I'm curious, you had mentioned kind of, you know, it sounded like when you were talking about kind of the directives from FASA and kind of where you're placing your story and your timeline, it kind of put it in that kind of pre-Twilight of the Clans. And so, one, I'm really interested in kind of the decisions that led to this story. Certainly for you, you know, being your first novel, and I'm not sure if it was your first novel ever, if it was just your first BattleTech novel, but certainly that first one benefits from the years and years of kind of, you know, musing on what story you want to tell. And I'm curious of kind of how those musings, you know, kind of manifested into that first novel for you, and how the kind of direction from Sam or the other higher ups at FASA in terms of bringing in Liao and Sun Tzu, but also the Periphery and focusing on the magistracy and those characters for the first time, and kind of how exciting was that for you as a fan? And then what were the kind of challenges of kind of developing that within the only story that you wanted to tell?
Double Blind was, I believe, the third full novel I had ever written. I had written two novels before that, just spec novels that never went anywhere. One large, fantasy genre novels. This was my first one writing a big military sci-fi piece. Now, I read a lot of military sci-fi. I was in the military for 5 years in the Navy. Mm-hmm. So I knew how to generate lingo and some of the culture of that. And I read a lot of military science fiction. So that was, you know, always a plus. Like I said, Brian, you know, from Sam's direction, Brian and Sam gave me 6 or 7 bullet points. You know, focus on, you know, bring the Confederation in, make him look cool. Mm-hmm. Talk, you know, hit on a mercenary, you know, hit on mercenary lifestyle of some type, make up a unit, bring in a new one or a one, whatever, they didn't care. They said, we're going to focus on the Periphery in coming source books and novels. So maybe like bring a Periphery nation in if you can, you know, focus on the Periphery a little bit. What else did they say? They talked about Word of Blake, that Word of Blake was up and coming. So, you know, mm-hmm. Word of Blake had to be doing something. So good. They gave me these big, a shotgun of bullet points that none of which connected to each other at that moment. There was no story. And so I had to come up with an idea of, okay, so I've got Word of Blake out in the periphery doing something. I have Sun Tzu, at the time, was going to send a Mercer unit out to the periphery to do something. And then those storylines would collide. And that's how I would get like all of these different factions involved in what was going on. As it turns out, the Mercer unit was not sent by Sun Tzu. So the Sun Tzu thread became its own. So I ended up with three plot lines. Mm-hmm. The angels coming off of New Home and heading out to the periphery, which is usually, you know, death for mercenaries. Right. But they were, you know, taking that shot. The Sun Tzu political, very short political plot line of him going out to the periphery. Mm-hmm. And then the Word of Blake is also out in the periphery on Astrakhazy, working with the, I think, the hegemony and Astrakhazy and doing stuff out there. Mm-hmm. And the angels and the Word of Blake kind of came head-to-head right away, where Sun Tzu's plotline was floating up above it, just showing that there was a bigger umbrella going on. As the big political players are moving around, you go down, you see, you know, the angels are at the front of this particular political wave doing all the fighting. And then you know that there is the Word of Blake thing out there, but the angel, nobody else knows that Word of Blake is doing this. That's something that's uncovered as they go. Yeah. And then they get to Astrakhazy and that all blows up. And then Sun Tzu comes in, and, you know, literally at, you know, I don't tie him into the very, very end where he comes strutting on stage on a mech to say, and I, my people, I am here to save you. And then, you know, that's what he does. He can ride it along in the parade. He can't fight. That's where it all tied together at the very end of those battles on Astrakhazy. And then, you know, then Sun Tzu, you know, caps Demona Aziz, I think it was. And you can see him tying, he's trying to yoke the Canopians to the Confederation. And while Emma Centrella is a very smart woman and a great leader, she's making, you know, she knows, oh, I can, I'll just milk them for all it's worth. I'm like, yeah, but you're still making a deal with the devil. Yeah. The devil's going to get his due. And eventually, I was Sun Tzu was playing a long game at that point, and you could already tell. I think even mentioned it in the first Sun Tzu chapter. He's not just looking at Canopus; he's looking at the Torii Concordat as well. Yep. That if he could basically, you know, get that all that strength funneled in through his direction, not only will the Confederation survive, he could go on the offensive in places. And that plot line was completely just spun out of whole cloth as I went. And that set a storyline that was moving for, oh my God, I mean, how long did that storyline run? 10 years? We're still dealing with the aftermath. I mean, he broke the Concordat. The Concordat actually kind of like fell apart under the, with Grover Strapland and all that, under the demands of the Confederation and the Trinity Alliance. And, so Sun Tzu kind of soaked them dry, brought the Canopians up as a real partner, but always with him able to keep his thumb on the direction it was going to point.
Right.
So that was a very long, I mean, that plot line could have been just a one and done, but because Fasa loved it, they kept bringing that back. And we kept the Canopians involved, the Taurians involved, and we're still telling that story. Even now in the Ill Clan era, the Centrellas and the Laos are still related in by blood in a lot of places. They still work together in a lot of places. They're having some difficulties at the moment. You know, the Canopians are starting to like maybe look at like, hey, should we screw with Lao at this moment? But in the end, you know, family's family, and I wouldn't turn my back on them.
Yeah. The you brought the Word of Blake as that third faction, and you know, I had, in my own kind of reread through, I made it up to a Blood of Heroes and skipped ahead to Double Blind to kind of get ready for our conversation. So there might've been stuff I missed there, but it also seemed like that was an early stage of Word of Blake kind of taking the place as Comstar, as kind of that master manipulating faction there. Is, you know, is that right? Was yours the first time where Word of Blake really kind of started to take that place, or was that a thread that had been kind of coming through? And did you guys know where that was going, or was it just kind of set the seed so that we could possibly use it later?
I believe Damona Aziz shows up in a Mike Stackpole novel or two before that moment. So she was already a character on stage, I believe. The 6th of June movement, I think, was mentioned somewhere in a source book, but not much more than that. That there was a movement called the 6th of June based on when, I'm probably getting this wrong, was it when Mindo Waterley was assassinated by Anastasius? I might be dropping the names wrong here, but anyway, 6th June was based on that and the idea of assassination as a tool of statecraft. Mm-hmm. Cameron Saint-Germain, I think, was a character I invented completely to be the leader of the 6th of June movement inside of Word of Blake. It's been a long time. I'm pretty sure I'm getting
this right. 25 years.
So some of this was already existing. Some of it I just tacked onto. We knew Word of Blake was going to be coming up, becoming more important. And eventually Word of Blake and Comstar were going to, you know, go head to head. We weren't sure how it was going to look. We just knew it was going to happen. They were going to be a competing Comstar faction, secularism versus spiritual versus the spirit, fake spiritualism, and to see where that went. When I realized later I had to kill Damona Aziz, that someone had to pay the price, you know, someone on the bad guy side had to kind of pay the price for this debacle out in the periphery. I originally really thought it would be Cameron Saint-Germain, and in the end ended up being Damona Aziz, and Cameron was a survivor, and he went on to become a major political figure, power player in the Inner Sphere, dealing with Catherine and other people, so being able to play at that level. At that point, I was pretty sure Damona Aziz had pretty much risen to the highest she was ever going to rise as a good character. At that point, I thought Cameron had more room to grow and be more interesting. So that's why Damona was the one that eventually they got capped by Sun Tzu. And she had a good scene on the way out, and it was a fun moment between Sun Tzu and Naomi, and continuing the education of Naomi Centrella.
Indeed. You had mentioned kind of the dueling nature of Comstar and Word of Blake, kind of as a yin and yang, and I, and reading that, I saw, and certainly kind of in the settings that you chose, a lot of similarities between kind of a Sunni and Shiite type of, coexistence and kind of friction within the culture, and certainly kind of the setting that you chose, for this book, in kind of a very Middle East type setting, a lot of the tribalistic traditions and culture there. Is that, certainly BattleTech kind of drawing from military history, is that kind of an intentional kind of parallel that you guys have taken through true history, or is that just kind of a, coincidence in terms of the similarities?
That's a great question. And unfortunately, I don't have a good answer. I would say that would be a question of Mike Stackpole, who is I believe he is a major in history. He's had a degree in history. Mm-hmm. It wouldn't surprise me at all that Mike was doing all that intentionally. I mean, in the end, Comstar was a pseudo-religious faction, mm-hmm. with a secular uprising. And when that happens, you always get conflict. You get heresies and splinter groups and all this other stuff that happens. History is resplendent with many, many examples. What was Mike's inspiration for that, and Fast's inspiration? Because I'm sure it was done. I'm sure this was not just Mike. I'm sure it was Mike and Brian and Sam in a meeting somewhere.
Yeah.
In a creative summit, talking about how they're going to split Comstar up into Comstar Word of Blake. That was probably, designed. But what his model was, it wouldn't surprise me, because he is a student of history. When I got it, it was already it was already on the path. So I was already told, this is who Word of Blake is, this is who Comstar is, just keep it going. And then the Astrakazi overlay was just completely random happenstance. I looked at some of the worlds that the final battle could have been on, looking for a fun place to explore. I found Astrakazi, and I'm not sure, one of the periphery Star Corps source books somewhere. And so I was like, right out of Tales of the what was it? The Arabian Nights tales, you know, Tales of Arabian Nights. Like that's all I knew about Astrakhazi. It was very kind of Middle Eastern, Arabian Nights, and that's what I had to work with. Everything else, I just kind of went from there and invented as I went and tried to come up with like some of these older Arabian tropes, like the whirling dervishes, the opulent pasha, shah, vizier kind of like lifestyle, the remnants in the desert who are always with their little ideas of like someday we will inherit the world, but meanwhile we're just trying to survive. And I just threw all that together and just kind of into a big bag and shook it up to see what would come out. So any parallels and other things that happened in there about is just completely by accident.
And I think one of the parts of that book that I enjoyed the most was your descriptions of the mounted horsemen and kind of, you know, combining that in infantry and mech tactics. Was that inspiration from various gameplay that you had done, or a particular interest in kind of the relationship between infantry and mechs? Because that theme did continue into Binding Force, which we'll talk on when we get there.
When I broke the angels and they went and they got scattered in the desert and they met the desert tribes, I had a vague idea the desert tribes would keep them alive and help them get back on their feet. As I invented the culture of these desert tribes out there, and it was just kind of came as I was writing, at that point I saw the final battle. I knew I was going to have these tribal warriors on horseback charging the field. And I had to make sure that, first of all, you would believe that they're crazy enough to do it, or they believe enough to do it. And I had to give them the chance to win. So they had, they already had enough native talent, and they were taught enough that they could literally ride horses against battle mechs and take some down, with swarming techniques. Battle mechs have always been, but battle mechs have always been susceptible to infantry swarm techniques.
Yeah.
But just the idea of a few mechs and this cavalry charge, I just thought this is something. It's right out of like, like Lawrence of Arabia kind of stuff. Like this whole thing where they're charging these superhuman, supersized walking tanks. Like this is going to look cool. And it's going to be a bloodbath, both. But it made for a very awesome way to bring, again, all these stories suddenly just come together in one moment. And that may be just one of the scenes, even today, is one of my top, like I say, five favorite scenes I have ever written for BattleTech. That is definitely one of them. And even today, people talk to me about that scene all the time. How it came together, how it was written, So I think I wrote something there that just is going to last because it's just, people keep bringing it up, 15, 20 years later, 20 years later.
It's 25, Lauren, not
25 years later. I don't know how old I
am. So moving on to Binding Force, first talk to me a little bit about kind of from a broader view, what you learned writing that first book and how you leveraged that into Binding Force, because having read them, like I could see the evolution of you as a writer, and it may have just been the story, in terms of how it flowed, but Binding Force, just there was a much, much more cohesive flow. Whereas I felt like Double Line, there were a lot of very interesting points, but with Binding Force, it was just like clean read through, easy page turner, in addition to those kind of, memorable scenes. And so I'm curious in terms of for you and your evolution, what happened? What did you learn? What lessons did you kind of try to leverage into Binding Force and then beyond with your writing from that first experience?
Nice thing about Binding Force was I was given a lot more just leeway to write whatever book I wanted to write. They said, I chose to go back to the Confederation. I'm pretty sure I was saying, well, we have an open slot. What do you want to write? But, I want to go back and write the Confederation book. I want to really explore these warrior houses. They look really cool.
Yeah.
The other thing they said was, in Binding Force, that they were, they're going to go on more of an aggressive stance to start doing stuff. That's all the direction. That one, I was only given very vague direction. Go do something cool. Show them being proactively, going out and trying to claim new territory or do whatever they need to do.
Yeah.
And I invented, you know, Arisung was, he came up, he came to mind right away. In fact, the first thing I wrote was the, I wrote that chapter of Arisung sneaking into the warehouse as a character backstory moment. Wasn't even sure if I would use it in the book, end up leading, you know, leading with that.
Yeah.
Because it was, it became so critical to the story of Eris. With Doughblind, I had been given, like I said, like 5-6 of these big plot points I had to roll together. And I was a brand new writer. Yeah, this was my third book I'd ever written in my life. So yeah, it was, I felt like I, you know, the chapter by chapter stuff was, I was solidly in my chapters, but I was playing with pretty powerful, you know, dynamite at that point. And I, the fact I did not completely blow up my face was awesome. With Binding Force, it was a smoother story. It was a smaller story too. I mean, obviously it took place mostly on one world with some flashbacks.
Yep.
So it was a smaller story. It was a story more about a handful of characters that were always, you know, somewhat nearby, and Eris's become, you know, Eris's journey to become part of that family that he'd always wanted. And it took him, you know, effectively, you know, decades, you know, to before he was actually finally accepted, even marginally, because he was always the outsider.
Yeah.
And that was the root of the story I wanted to tell. So more focused character, pantheon, smaller plot line stories, because we're not dealing with these, you know, major political figures all, you know, doing their thing. It was just, I could back up and take a breath. That's why it felt smoother. And I didn't know I would ever come back to them. I didn't know I was going to later do, you know, the Capellan Solution books, back to Arisung and the Warrior House. At that point, I had no idea I was going to do that. I was just doing this one story. I thought it'd be another one and done. Yeah, it was a very smooth, very smaller, smoother story. Absolutely.
And I'm assuming, you know, those mini reads of the Capellan source book is what kind of inspired to pursue the warrior houses. What is it that kind of captured your imagination with those?
That there is a spiritualism and a mythos. Every culture has its own myths, its own traditions and culture and myths that become ingrained. Being able to explore that was fascinating. Be able to explore the spiritual, like, you know, the warrior monk kind of a philosophy is to me what kind of caught me, I think, originally with the warrior houses, that they were both confederation and yet somewhat independent, and how that would work. House Ritsu was just luck of the draw, I think. I looked for one that had just almost nothing written on them, so they were a blank slate. I could create what I wanted without worrying about doing anything that was considered, like, you know, against continuity. There was almost nothing written about them at all. So I think there was, like, the name of the warrior house leader, whose name I can't remember off the top of my head at the moment. But I think that was it. House Iritsu, here's their current leader. That's all they knew. So I was able to just move forward from there. And so, again, when you're writing these books, when you're writing any book, as the writer, you're looking for a character that engages you as a writer, and a story that you want to explore, and a culture or a setting that you want to explore. Generally, that's why writers aren't usually content to just sit there and tell the same character in the same setting over and over and over again.
Right.
Because some people do that, but most writers tend to want to push themselves to grow as well. And so I looked for things like that, and the warehouses caught my attention. When I invented Arisung, then I knew I had the right character, as the, you know, he was the eternal outsider, always looking for acceptance. And that's something I think any reader has, we've all had those thoughts along the way in our lives, that, you know, we're always, you know, on the outside looking in, wanting acceptance. So I was playing with a very familiar theme that everyone could relate to. And I just rolled with it. I set it up. And like most of my books, I don't plan it out to the very end. I set up the beginning. I have a vague idea where I want to end, and I just push it forward. And then the writing takes me where the writing takes me. And generally, I hit somewhere near where I was aiming for, but I get surprised along the way.
Yeah.
I didn't know Eris was going to get separated from his unit and go solo for a while. That was not my, the whole jump in the water and how to get a mech underwater. Mm-hmm. That was completely like when it happened, I'm like, oh, okay. So mostly because I thought this is getting too easy.
Yeah.
And so I had to get Eris out on his own. I had to split them up to have some, you know, break up into multiple plot lines and bring them back together. And, you know, doing a whole chapter about how could you get out of a mech that's submerged in a lake? I mean, that kind of thing. And then come back with some Capellan culture with the dragon boat races. We can get to his mech again and all that kind of stuff. So, you go where the writing leads you at that point. And if that means you are aiming for a new ending, well, so be it.
That's very cool to hear. Like the air pressure in the cockpit I found particularly interesting. I wonder if that is a Navy, you know, you pulled that out of your Navy experience of things.
A little bit. I mean, this, you know, and also I'm a scuba diver. So, I mean, I understood how to equalizing pressure and how that works with submersibles. So, yeah. I mean, I pulled a little bit of everything from my experience in the military and in my scuba diving experience. And just, it was just a problem to solve. And it wasn't, as long as you can control some very basic elements, it wasn't too hard to do. The question was how much water I wanted to get in the cockpit for later for having water sloshing around in there just for fun.
Right. And that's also very cool to hear that you hadn't planned that separation, because, you know, that separation plays wonderfully into the backstory that you had laid for Eris, you know, as kind of the street urchin, you know, the pickpockets, you know,
and Maverick, you know, kind of a Maverick character. He'd be the guy that would break off on his own because it was, mm-hmm. that's what was in front of him. That was the best decision for him to make at the time. Mm-hmm. And then it was all about getting home again. Yeah. And even
how no other, mech warrior in that unit could have done what he did in terms of infiltrating the local, you know, underground population, using that to kind of leverage for information. It was just a very fun, cool element of this.
That's what the Warrior House leader saw in him from the beginning. Mm-hmm. And then Ty, his immediate commander, almost never recognized until really toward the very end, that the Warehouse leader saw in him that this is something that we don't have. This is potentially an arrogance, a view, a level of, desperate competency that we are lacking. So she saw that this was something that could make the warehouse stronger over generations. Eris was a catalyst for growth for that warehouse. That's how I always thought the warehouse leader saw him as. And then when Ty Nan became the warehouse leader, then or later, that was part of his growth as a commander, as a leader, to accept the fact that Eris has something to offer the warehouse. And I'm probably now blending into the Capellan Solution books along the way there. That was always kind of the plan, that there was, you know, you got the person who sees value in the young gunner punk, and the guy right in the middle who's resisting change the whole way through. So Eris was a catalyst for change.
And there was, you know, quick aside, you know, thank you. You know, I always like to kind of paint maps that describe things. And so you describing Eris's Wraith as metallic blue and only metallic blue. As a novice painter, it's very easy to paint a metallic blue Wraith. I'll tell you.
I have seen so many versions. So yeah. That metallic gunmetal blue, I've had so many people show me their idea of what that is.
Yeah.
It was just a fun comment I made, and I have seen so many painters show me, here's what I think gunmetal blue is on a battle mech, and it's always awesome. Yeah. Just one little, again, just a little throwaway thing I did, and yet it has inspired people to paint the Wraith.
Yeah,
and I've seen so many versions of it, and each one is fun. I love it.
Yeah, awesome. Yeah, and I took Bruce's artwork for the cover and turned it into a TCG card as well. So yeah, I've had a little fun with that. One element of this book that I also found very fun, and there was a little bit of in Double Blind, was just that there was a large section focused on the zero G combat operations. And certainly there's a naval element to that, you know, adding the zero G element to the naval side. But, is that something that particularly fascinated you and you wanted to kind of explore in your books? Or is it just something that kind of happened to fit in the story and that you just ran from each of those first two novels?
Yeah, the zero. So again, looking for. I'm trying to remember when I did the where the zero G chapter was in Double Blind. I remember there was that the.
There was an agent sent to try to assassinate them, and
yeah, it was a zero
Giovanni had stumbled
G,
on them. Yeah, they were trying to sabotage the mechs, and then they stumbled on one of those.
It was a zero G like fist fight kind of thing, wasn't it?
Yeah,
they're going on. So I was trying at that point. I knew I needed to do something just to bring in some tension, that there was something going on, and I knew there would be like a saboteur. The zero G thing was just as I recall, reading back 25 years. Was just a way to add some spice to it, you know, to do something different. I don't remember us having seen that very much.
Yeah.
And it was just like, you know, I would make it in during zero G evolution. So just to make it difficult, as opposed to just, hey, you stop. And then they punch each other and someone falls down. I needed to make it to more of a tactical problem that you got to now surmount this zero G issue as well. So I believe I brought that in just to make the chapter more entertaining than just I caught a saboteur. What's going on? So it drew out the action scene a little bit. And again, when I do chapters like that, if the chapter feels too simple, I look for some way to complicate it. It could just be a character we didn't expect to walk in on it, the zero G evolutions. Or something like the equalizing the pressure under the I find something to do to spend some time on a real a new problem. To, oh, I wouldn't know how to do that. So let's see how it works. And and so something like that. So it just came in. That one just came in just on a whim. But I've done that now a couple times in different books. Like played around with like you know either a zero G evolution or some of the. Idea of how zero-G warship combat would work. I got to do a lot of that in the Federation Civil War, and that was a lot of fun. And just, you know, I look for things just to play and try to show something that's never been done before or show it in a new way that's never been done. That obviously, like well, the first time I jumped and showed a ship jump next to each other and literally ripped the spine out of the other ship. Like that's always been in BattleTech. You don't jump next to other, you know, other cores. Bad things happen. But no one, to my knowledge, had ever shown that before. So I look for moments like that. People go, "Yeah, I knew that was a possibility. That was really cool."
Yeah.
So awesome. I look for things like that.
I don't know if you, you know, with all the commitments that you have with CGL, I don't know how much time you get to look at what the fans are doing, but there was one of my most recent podcasts was with a fan named Devin Ramsey, and he had created Operation Lancaster, which was like a 500-page PDF, which is like a whole campaign, a novel, short stories, TROs, truly magnificent, you know, fan project. And there was a lot of zero G in that as well, which kind of you know, made me think about it here. You know, I'd recommend, you know, it's about 60 pages for the story itself. You know, if you have an interest, I definitely recommend checking that out.
Well, I hope he takes some of that and we have shrapnel. I mean, he could send pieces of that.
Last I talked, I think he was third or fourth in line. And so he's on his way there. But, and actually,
I do read a lot of fan stuff whenever, you know, I trip over fan stuff all the time. And I'll always pop my head in, take a look around, and if I see something worth mentioning, I might drop a note to someone. I came in as a brand new freelancer, and I always encourage people. I love what I do, and it's led to a very fun career doing awesome stuff. And I always try to encourage people, if you love this, then write, submit, put it up. You know, we have Shrapnel now, which is a great place for people to go and get early publication credits and learn how to do what we do. And obviously, you know, always will color outside the lines, but stay on the page. You know, don't go trying to create a brand new BattleTech, but do something we haven't seen before. Show us a piece of BattleTech that we've never seen before. There are thousands of potential story points that we will never see. BattleTech is too big. So someone says, "Oh, I don't know all the stories that have been taken." No, there are thousands of stories that we have never even come close to seeing. Find something fun, and then focus on that. Don't try to reinvent a war. The war. Don't try to reinvent a faction. Tell a fun story about something we haven't ever really experienced, and that's how you get into this universe. How you get published. How you get asked to write more. Same with source books. You want to stay within. You want to stay on the page, but you occasionally want to color outside the lines Because otherwise, if someone says, well, I could have written that, that's not the reaction you want. You want to go, oh, I never thought about it that way. Or, oh, that was a really cool twist. Yeah. And that's where you make a name and you become a favorite author, I think. You just become a place people fans come back to because you're going to surprise them in the little ways, not the big ways.
Definitely. And actually, you know, I have a note that Devin wanted me to share with you that was related to his own experience with BattleTech. And I always like to share a little fun little anecdotes that make people feel good. So I'm going to read this for him. So this is from Devin Ramsey, creator of Operation Lancaster. So Lauren Coleman actually had a positive impact on my relationship with my mother back when I was a senior in high school. For the longest time, she hadn't really approved of BattleTech, most likely because she viewed it as a violence without substance. After becoming extremely frustrated with her negativity regarding BattleTech, I wanted to show her that there's a genuine substance to the property. I had just finished reading BattleTech's then newest book, Endgame, and I decided to take a chance. I gave the book to her to read. The difference in her attitude regarding BattleTech was night and day. She still had no personal interest in it, which is not surprising, but the negativity was gone overnight. Thank you, Lauren.
That is awesome. And that is exactly why I write. Would I write the way that, oh, this will help someone have a better relationship with their mother someday? No. But I try to write stories that challenge people mentally and emotionally as well. And Endgame, those three books, Ending and Endgame, were there was a lot of emotion wrapped up in there with, you know, Victor was falling apart, his friends were trying to put him back together. There were a lot of amazing patriotic moments as well as personal moments in that book. So yeah, the fact that assisted someone to have a better relationship with their mom, dude, how can you not feel something, you know, feel wonderful about that? So yeah, it was Devin, right?
Devin, yeah.
And yeah, that makes that right there. That has made my day. Seriously, that was a beautiful letter and a beautiful anecdote. And yeah, thank you. That's great.
You're welcome. So, you know, you've been putting all these people on the spot of what BattleTech means to you. So can I put you on the spot? I'll get my only little short clip video and you can share it on the Cattle's website. So Lauren, yeah. what does BattleTech mean to you?
Possibilities. It means to me, it's a place where I get to explore a lot of what I want to as a writer and as a reader of military science fiction. This is not just about the glorification of violence, that it's about the cost of ambition, the cost of patriotism, the cost of nationalism. It's about what we pay for what we believe. It's about the possibility, the endless possibilities that are out there for us as an extra planet, extra solar system society, that in the end, human nature is not going to change that much. We are still a very weird species that will sometimes do awful things, and then we can do amazing things. And that's never going to change about us. And that's what's our strength, as well as just what makes life worth living and worth reading about. So BattleTech for me is about all the possibilities of who we are, what we can become, but also that baggage of, you know, to be a free-willed, ambitious species. That means we will take with us our grudges, our biases with us wherever we go. And we have to overcome that. Every generation, every family, every person. And in my stories, that's always what's going on. They are overcoming something that's very, very human with the backdrop of a universe always on the edge of burning itself to the ground, because that's the legacy of our drive to explore, to better, to look over the next hill. That's always a legacy we bring with us. So that to me, that's what BattleTech allows me to do. And that's what BattleTech means to me, is the ability to explore all the possibilities that are out there. Whether I'm writing or Mike Stackpole or Randall Bills, whoever's writing, is that ability to look and see where, what will this cost us? What are we getting and what will it cost us? And we got cool, really big stompy robots. So, you know, with a great video, so we have some great tech to play with and just a lot of fun.
Thanks for sharing, Lauren.
Yeah.
So stepping away from the novel side and the creator side, I want to kind of, you know, have you put your CEO hat on and we can kind of start talking about Catalyst and kind of the management side.